From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The U.S. Department of Justice has announced charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The charges are connected to WikiLeaks' release of documents from former Army private Chelsea Manning 9 years ago, and they come just hours after Assange was arrested. Assange was dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy, where he had been given asylum for nearly 7 years. At one point, he yelled, "The UK must resist." We're going to get some wider context from the U.S. on the arrest, but first to the U.K., where the arrest was made. Jonathan Marcus is BBC defense and diplomatic correspondent. He is in London. Hi, Jonathan.
Yes, hi.
Describe the scene of Julian Assange being carried out of the embassy by a number of police today. He didn't look at all like the man we recall from when he first went into asylum 7 years ago, did he?
He didn't. I mean, he looked very much like a recluse, a heavy white beard. He was actually sort of bundled into a police van. He wasn't walking. We understand now that actually he tried to evade the officers when they entered the embassy. And so effectively he had to be restrained and physically manhandled out of the building. Of course, that was done after an agreement between the British authorities and the Ecuadorian government. They believed that Mr. Assange had effectively outstayed his welcome. They said that he had broken the terms under which he was allowed to remain in the embassy, and that's why they decided to hand him over effectively to the British authorities.
Right, so that brings up the question of why the arrest happening today, and what exactly were these bail conditions that he supposedly breached?
Well, I mean, let's put it in the vernacular. He was a huge amount of trouble. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he wasn't a sort of compliant house guest. But I think clearly the factors that were at play were importantly the change of administration in Ecuador itself, a new government, much more eager to get rid of this particular problem. Also, I think the fact that WikiLeaks appears to have been involved in releasing material about the Ecuadorian president himself wouldn't have helped. The fact that he appeared to have been continuing some of his activities whilst based in the embassy wouldn't have helped. So I think it's a whole range of things. But of course, the change of political regime is obviously a fundamental one.
So Ecuador released him, the UK arrested him, and the Department of Justice in the US has announced charges against Julian Assange. Is there evidence that the US pressured Ecuador to basically kick him out and end his asylum?
Well, there have been suggestions that that was the case. I haven't seen any actual compelling evidence of that fact. I mean, what's now been revealed in more detail is the US extradition request. Of course, that, interestingly, in the first instance, is based on an allegation of federal charges of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. In other words, he helped Chelsea Manning to break into a classified government, American government computer.
You should say Chelsea Manning being the former Army private.
Correct, absolutely. The initial American extradition request relates to a crime that I understand is likely to, if he were to be found guilty, is likely to involve 5 years or less in prison. Of course, some media sources are saying that the U.S. authorities are considering other charges as well.
Is he in line to be extradited to the U.S. to face these charges?
Well, he will have to go through the extradition process. I mean, remember, he's already been through one extradition process when it was the Swedish authorities who were after him for two sets of charges, one relating to sexual molestation and one to rape. Now, one of those charges has simply disappeared because the statute of limitations has expired. The rape charge is interesting because the statute of limitations there, I understand, has not expired, and we have seen reports in the press that the lady concerned and her lawyer are interested in Sweden in trying to get those charges reinstated. So, you know, potentially he could face, well, he's faced one legal jeopardy already for the bail, for skipping bail. There are two other potential cases, but obviously the American one is the most significant in broader political terms. So this isn't likely to be over, I think, very, very quickly. But it does look on the face of it as though the Americans do perhaps have a chance of getting hold of him.
In the meantime, where is Julian Assange now?
I think he's in custody. I can't tell you precisely where he's in custody, but he is in custody. And clearly, with his past record, I don't think anybody is likely to be letting him out anytime soon. You know, this has been a very long-running saga. It's cost the British taxpayer a fortune. Now, for some people, there are huge issues of information freedom and the freedom of individuals to stand up against authority on the one side. Of course, on the other side, there are people who think he's just a kind of troublemaker, in some cases even a willing fool who has helped to facilitate Russian interference with the American election campaign, for example. So, you know, there are absolutely broadly, dramatically different interpretations of Mr. Assange and the project in which he has been involved, WikiLeaks. It divides people, but one must say there are still some, you know, more liberal legal experts. There's certainly a small coterie of supporters of him who have not backed away over the years and who continue to support him significantly up to this day.
BBC Defence and Diplomatic Correspondent Jonathan Marcus in London. Thank you again, Jonathan.
Pleasure.
So, hero or troublemaker, or worse, villain, traitor, where will history put Julian Assange? Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He helps us put today's questions in historical perspective. And Julian, we thought immediately, of course, of Daniel Ellsberg, a researcher at RAND who released the so-called Pentagon Papers showing the government wasn't telling the truth about the Vietnam War. Your thoughts?
Well, there are similarities, and the most important one is that the data that was dumped or the information that was shared in the end did reveal some wrongdoing in the government in different ways. But they're also, in my mind, very different. Ellsberg released the Pentagon study through formal media institutions, the New York Times and the Washington Post initially, which had editorial controls and production controls. He wasn't accused of stealing or helping to steal the information. And it was also just a different era in politics in terms of how information circulated. So I don't think they're exactly the same.
Well, some would say that it's Chelsea Manning that's either the hero or traitor, depending on how you look at it, because she paid the consequences for getting those documents to Assange. But it's so interesting. You say, you know, it depends on what was dumped. And as we just heard, we're reminded that, you know, the WikiLeaks printed the DNC emails. And some might think, yeah, that was a great thing. But then, you know, it was the Russians who stole those. So it's kind of funny. I mean, you can look at it through different prisms.
And Ellsberg, obviously, back in the 70s, was trying to reveal how we got into a bad war. And the story about Assange and his relation to the 2016 election, which is not part of today's arrest,
right,
colors him in a different way. That not only might he have been part of taking information illegally, but also that he had political motives, that there was a partisan element to what he did. And I think we can't separate those two stories as people make judgments about what happened.
Well, you know, WikiLeaks is saying that this is a question of freedom of the press. Your thoughts on that?
Well, there are many defenders of WikiLeaks who say just that, that Assange is a journalist and that he should be afforded the protections of journalism. I think it's still more complicated. I'm not an expert, but WikiLeaks is different than a newspaper or even a television network in that it was directly giving these sensitive documents without any kind of analysis or filter to the public. And so I think that's why the case becomes a little trickier.
Yeah. And how does it fit into President Trump's attacks on the media, enemy of the people?
Well, I think it's hard for critics of Assange, many critics of Assange, to make their case in some ways because of the president. The president has ongoing attacks on the news media, has threatened institutions of journalism. So I think there are going to be many people reluctant to say, well, maybe there's a case here, because they fear fueling the president's rhetoric, yeah, a dangerous rhetoric in the minds of many observers.
Well, we only have a minute here, a minute or so, but I've wondered your thoughts, because there are two stories that are intersecting here, the arrest of Julian Assange and the imminent release of a redacted version of the Mueller report. And, you know, if Julian Assange had his way, that Mueller report would come right out without any redactions. Your thoughts on how, you know, people, there's a people who would support a media in which if you got your hands on those, you just publish them.
Look, there are reasons to have redactions, and there's reason to be cautious with these kinds of reports, because there's lots of information culled together. But this is why congressional oversight is essential. We have an institution that can look into this as well before the public sees it and make sure the redactions are legitimate rather than political. And that's going to need to happen with the Mueller report. Otherwise, many people won't trust what they see.
Well, which institution is that? Because right now people don't trust some of the institutions.
Well, the institution is the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. I think the Democrats have a role to play right now in seeing why Mueller is making the decisions he does. And yeah. I think people like Congressman Nadler are going to check.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, also co-author with Kevin Cruz of the terrific book Fault Lines, A History of the U.S. Since 1974. Great read. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
The book North tells the story of ultra-marathoner Scott Jurek and his attempt to set the speed record for the Appalachian Trail. His wife, Jenny, was the primary member of his support team. Scott Jurek navigated 2,189 miles from Georgia to Maine. He did it in 46 days, 8 hours, and 7 minutes. An enthusiastic crowd of well-wishers greeted him at the top of Maine's Mount Katahdin. It was the culmination of a 46-day endurance trial that he and Jenny write about in the book North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. We spoke with the pair when the book was first published. It's out in paperback this week. When Scott Jurek decided to attempt the Appalachian Trail, he had already had success as an ultra-marathoner, including 7 straight wins in the Western States Endurance Run. So we asked him, why the Appalachian Trail next?
Well, I think, you know, after racing for 20 years, I still had a few things I wanted to do, but I was kind of spinning my wheels. I needed a new challenge, something to really kind of push me to those boundaries that other challenges had done in the past.
And Jenny, you didn't really like the idea of his doing the trail in the beginning, did you?
Well, it just seemed really random to me, and it seemed like something really involved that would take a lot of planning. And from the previous races I'd seen, he wasn't really into it. Like, his heart wasn't into it. So I didn't want to put all this time and effort into doing something that he wasn't going to do wholeheartedly and with that passion. But I did realize, you know, that it was a way to reignite that fire for him.
But Jenny, this way involves you because you ended up kitting out a van, the two of you did, and driving to Georgia to begin the trail. And you really have to manage. I mean, what was your job through the whole ordeal?
I mean, my main job was just to be like a roving support aid station, you know, just to provide food and water and supplies at several road crossings every day. It doesn't sound that hard, but I didn't have any cell service or GPS to really like help me with the navigation. And I had to get gas and get groceries and
do my dirty laundry.
Do his laundry. Yeah.
That's just all true love right there.
Yeah. All the little daily things that needed to get done.
And Scott, meanwhile, from up atop the trail, tell us what it was like for you.
Jenny definitely had the tougher job. I just had to follow those white blazes that are iconic on the Appalachian Trail and also go up and down these mountains, you know, climbing each day. I mean, the trail climbs 500,000 feet up, 500,000 feet down over 2,200 miles. So a lot of days involve 10,000 to 13, 15,000 feet of climbing and 10 to 15,000 feet of descent. And so it definitely was challenging in its own right. Amidst that, we decided to open up the journey and let people in on it by occasionally posting on social media, but we also had a tracker and people could literally follow along wherever they were. And as we got along the trail, we had basically people showing up at trailhead, sometimes, you know, 10, sometimes 20, 30, and some were definitely a little bit, probably more overbearing on Jenny because she had to answer all their questions as they were hanging out. But they also got to join me for miles. So it really was this social, and I think that's what the Appalachian Trail, it is a social trail. It was designed to connect people as well as nature.
So people would run with you as well?
Exactly.
Did that hold you back? I mean, you were doing this to time.
It probably wasn't the best. My buddy Speed Goat, who's in the book, joined us 2 weeks in because he's like, man, you guys need help. And he was like, this is slowing you down. You got to get rid of that tracker. And for some reason, for me, I just felt like I needed that connection. And I loved hearing the stories from people, but it did get a little old to answer all their questions. And I know some people were out there like, he's answering the same questions every time somebody pulls into the next trailhead and they're joining them for the next, 5 or 10 miles. But I also got a lot of inspiration from those people.
Yeah, you know, I actually heard about the fact that you were doing the Appalachian Trail from a teenager who lives nearby and who was on the trail alone and ran into you. And she was surprised that you answered her questions as well, and she was really kind of enchanted. But you have your own personal thoughts and personal trials, and I'm thinking of your mother in particular, and this is the kind of thing that you would think about when you were on the trail.
Yeah, she struggled with multiple sclerosis for over 30 years, and at a young age, I saw my mother gradually lose more and more of her physical capabilities, and she gave me perspective. It reminded me that I had two legs that maybe weren't always in the best shape and had injuries and had their own issues, but she was a reminder that, I'm able to move my body, and she couldn't even do that.
When you're, trying to get from one place to the next, and you run into all sorts of obstacles, there are poisonous snakes on the route. At one point, the two of you, I think, met a bear on the trail. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. A mother bear with two cubs, which is the type of bear you don't want to run into because they're the most aggressive. We end up having to go through this, pile of rocks that rattlesnake probably infested and poison ivy all over. And Jenny is just like, I can't believe we're doing this, just so we could, tack along right along the trail, but give the mama bear enough room with her cubs.
On a day-to-day, actually minute-by-minute level, what was it like for you, Scott? These are the questions you probably are sick of answering, but I think everybody has them. I mean, how would you sleep? How would you eat? Did you ever shower over 46 days?
It really came down to, how am I going to fuel myself, take care of myself? Showers got thrown out of the window. Maybe I'd bathe in a creek, or maybe it became, basically a wet towel at the end of the night. And sometimes I just roll into bed. Sometimes I slept on the trail, on rocks, or when I would take naps for a half hour here and there. Things became more and more dire and more, primitive as we went along.
And when that happened, did you ever stop and just say, well, why am I doing this again?
Definitely. I mean, every day there were times when I'm like, why am I doing this? This is just stupid. Can I be doing this via another, means or another activity or passion? Maybe I need to find a different hobby. I'm not going to lie. There were times where I told Jenny, it seemed like it was pulling us apart rather than bringing us together.
Because you had different ideas of what you wanted to do. I mean, at that point, you were how old?
I was 41 at the time.
And that was a big factor in your decision.
Definitely. Definitely towards the end of my career, I needed something. And I also wanted to save some of these bigger challenges because I knew it would take experience, not only in sport and what I love to do, but also in life. Jenny and I had struggled with trying to raise a family, having children. And, I watched Jenny almost die in my arms on our kitchen floor a year and a half prior in it. And so it was one of these things where, life is short. And we need to do this now.
Jenny, what Scott was just referring to there was that you had, and you write about this in the book, an ectopic pregnancy. The baby was developing in your fallopian tube. At the time that Scott was running the Appalachian Trail, you had suffered from the effects of a miscarriage that you'd had earlier, but you kept that fact from him then?
I had suffered from two miscarriages, and then deep in the middle of Maine in the section called the 100-mile wilderness, there's really no access to anything. And that's about where I suffered from residual effects of my most recent miscarriage. And I wasn't anywhere near a shower or even a phone to ask my doctor what to do. So that was a little worrisome, but I wasn't about to mention it to Scott because I knew he would freak out and I knew that he would consider stopping, and we were just too close. And I just kind of risked it and hoped that everything would be okay. And it was.
I give you guys a lot of credit for the openness with which you tell your individual stories. I mean, you're such a good pair, but you talk about the friction. And like you said, you talk about the fact that it's hard to stay together with things in your life and with the things that you want to do with your life. What's worked?
I don't know. I think just that we're good communicators.
And understanding each other. I think that's a key part, too, is we trade off and take turns. I knew climbing Half Dome for her was a really big life goal. And so I risked some of my fears of like going up slabs of rocks and heights and all these things and doing something that I wouldn't normally like to do. But for her, and I think in a partnership or in a team atmosphere, you have to be willing to not just sacrifice, but give when you need to give and then receive when you need to receive. Yes, there were times that, you know, we had a couple of blowouts out on the trail, but we still came together and communicated after. And I think realized like why we were doing this instead of packing it up and going home, like we thought about doing as we were getting very close to the end.
You both also had to deal with a lot of flack that was coming in from the outside. People saying, look, you're running this beautiful trail that misses the point. How did you respond to that?
Well, I think the initial response is Jenny and I get emotional a little bit, but then I've gotten used to I'm going to have haters. 90 some percent, whether it's 99 or 98% of the people out there. In fact, all the thru hikers that I would spend time with, they loved the fact of what I was doing and they understood like we got the thru hiking experience and we did really enjoy it. I wasn't moving much faster than most thru hikers. I just spent more time on the trail each day. There were days that I didn't stop moving.
In the end, you beat the old record, Scott, by 3 hours, 13 minutes. You didn't hold the record for long, though. Is that okay?
Oh, it's definitely okay. And I don't think it's a major spoiler because a lot of people could look this up. But I went back and helped my buddy Speed Goat, and I watched him break my record those last 10 days. And I think that's what the sport is all about. I think that's what life is about. You should help even, you know, somebody who's your competitor, maybe friend, raise the bar, do something that they didn't think they could do. And it wasn't so much about the record. The record was the tool to push me that next level that I needed to push myself, to really see if I could get every ounce of effort out of my body, mind, and soul. It was really this all-encompassing. It was like living, I guess, multiple lifetimes. If I were to sum it up, it was like, you know, life experiences that you could only have by pushing yourself that far.
Scott and Jenny Jurek, their book is called North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. So nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you
so much, Lisa.
Our interview with Scott and Jenny Jurek aired last April. North is now out in paperback.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, control your comfort.
In Louisiana, a deputy sheriff's son is under arrest, accused of setting those fires that burned down three historically black churches over the past month. Here's Governor John Bel Edwards.
I don't know what this young man's motive was. I don't know what was in his heart, but I can say it cannot be justified or rationalized. These were evil acts. But let me be clear about this. Hate is not a Louisiana value.
The FBI is investigating whether racial bias was involved, but fire officials say the suspect, 21-year-old Holden Matthews, who's white, was involved in a music known as black metal, which has been associated with church burnings and has a neo-Nazi fringe. Hillary Shelton, director of the NAACP's Washington, D.C. office, joins us now. We caught him on the phone. And Hillary, I know this is fresh news today, but when you heard it, what did you think?
Well, it was actually good to see that a suspect had been apprehended, and it was also good to see that the investigation will continue. Clearly, you have three churches that were burned within miles of each other and within just a little while of each other as well. Yeah. So as such, we're delighted to see that something has been done, but quite frankly, we still need to find out a lot of information about this as we think about the impact this is having not only on those church parishioners themselves, but the very community in which these churches are located.
Well, and by the way, we're told that the office of the father, again, who's the deputy sheriff, had been investigating these fires. He reportedly helped turn his son in. He's still on the job. He's said to have known nothing about his son's involvement in the fires. But you know that historically there have been other fires in the area. There's now, you know, there are people looking at whether there's a link to some unsolved fires 3 years ago. There's a history here, too. 30 predominantly African-American churches were burned across the U.S. in 1996. Churches in the 90s were burned by people associated with this black music. Did you know about this?
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, we worked on those church burnings you're speaking about in the 90s as well. At the time, Deval Patrick was actually the assistant general secretary for civil rights in the country, our attorney general for civil rights, mm-hmm. that is, in the country. And a black church burning task force was actually created here in Washington as well to address those issues. Mm. So I'm very much aware of that and, of course, what's happened with these three more recent burnings.
Yeah.
But I think it's also important to note that there was a church burned in the same county right around the same time that Dylann Roof was actually apprehended and caught. So there's a question about what the connection is between, if there is one, between these church burnings, the church burnings that happened behind the Dylann Roof killings, as yes. you remember, in Charleston, South Carolina.
Sure, he killed the parishioners there. And
exactly.
you're looking to see if there's a tie between Dylann Roof and black metal music. But, of course,
absolutely.
Churches were burned in the South in the 50s, 60s, you know, in the hundreds. Is there, you say that there's some relief, but in the few seconds we have, probably some fear.
Oh, well, there is. I mean, number one, we still don't have a conviction yet. We don't know if he was involved in all three of the burnings.
Yeah.
Also, we know there's been an increase in hate groups throughout the country, white supremacist groups as well,
yeah.
and individual members.
I'm going
so
to have to
a tie that's deeply concerning.
I'm going to have to leave it there. Hillary Shelton, director of the NAACP's Washington, D.C. office, we thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me.
CNN did it in 2014, NPR did it in 2016, and The Atlantic did it last year. Those news organizations and more have eliminated their comments section or moved them to Facebook. Well, this week, The Wall Street Journal took a different approach. It notified its readers that the paper's comment section is now only open to members. Here and Now's media analyst John Carroll joins us with the details. Hi, John.
Hi, Lisa.
Why have so many media outlets eliminated comments?
Well, there are a couple of big factors. One is what's known as Godwin's Law, which is basically that any comments thread, no matter what the topic, will eventually devolve into someone calling someone else a Nazi. So that's problematic.
You've seen that, have you?
a little bit. The other thing is that there's a really small universe of commenters on most online sites. So there was a study of NPR a couple of years ago. Less than 1% of visitors to npr.org were commenters, and over half of the comments came from a really small group. So it's not really representative of the readership.
Now, some publishers have allowed comments, but they've kind of offshored them. How?
Right. Well, USA Today, Indianapolis Star, they've basically moved them to Facebook. So they've got some distance from them. The Atlantic actually has a separate website called the Letter Section. It has the reader response there. And some websites have a button so that you have to click on it before you can get to the comments.
Okay. So that brings us to this week in the Wall Street Journal, which has instituted a kind of walled garden of feedback, members only, which I think probably means subscribers
right.
only. So is the idea that subscribers are more likely to keep the conversation civil than the great unwashed who don't subscribe?
There's that. The journal has found that their heavy commenters a lot of times don't really read the stories. They comment on the comments. What they're trying to do is basically encourage lighter commenters to become more involved, more engaged with the content.
Meaning they think that they're going to subscribe?
No,
so they can make comments?
Well, they think they're going to have a personal relationship with the website that goes beyond just reading it. I mean, online reading is really reading and writing in many ways.
So are there other limitations the journal initiated?
Right. Well, they're basically calling comments audience conversations. They say they'll only be on certain articles for a set amount of time. Their moderators are now called audience voice reporters. And basically they are looking to keep the comments focus by putting a question at the top of the comments page.
To suggest
that this is the direction your comment should go in.
And how's that working out?
Well, I looked at an editorial yesterday called Incoherent on Immigration. It was about Donald Trump's wholesale firing of immigration enforcement officials. There are about 700 comments. They seem to be pretty moderate. There was a minimum of all caps responses. So far, so good, I guess.
Is anybody else introducing innovations to the flow of comments?
The New York Times gets about 12,000 comments a day. They've introduced some machine learning technology to sort through the comments, prioritize them, and in some cases, automatically authorize them.
And meanwhile, there's another vehicle I know of, and you've talked about this, to give people a forum to talk and to keep it all clean. It's called the Coral Project. What's that about? Very briefly.
Right. That's an open source platform that basically tries to keep the conversation civil. There are a number of publications that are using it.
Put out by Vox Media. John right. Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. We have a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Also in the news today, the world's largest democratic process begins in India. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is fighting for a second term in office. There are 900 million eligible voters in India and 1 million polling stations. Election officials have tried to get electronic voting machines accessible to every voter. They've climbed mountains, crossed rivers by foot, and traveled to isolated areas on elephants to do it. A major concern in this election is the spread of fake news on social media. India has the largest number of WhatsApp users in the world. The app is owned by Facebook. The company has struggled to fight the sharing of false information. The BBC's Rahul Tandon is in Kolkata, India. Hi, Rahul.
Hi, Lisa.
So Facebook and WhatsApp have been fighting the spread of fake news across its platforms. We want to find out how, but first we want to know about the scale of this problem. How bad is the spread of misinformation during this election?
It's a huge problem, Lisa. Look, India has 900 million people who could potentially vote in the election process that began on Thursday. And political parties want to get information to them. Every vote could be crucial in this particular election. So what we've seen over the last few months is a huge amount of information circulated. The difficulty is that some of the information that is coming from political parties appears to be fake, and it keeps getting forwarded and forwarded again, even though companies like WhatsApp have taken steps to try and prevent that. And you also have to remember that this is a country where we still have a large section of the population who is not fully literate, who when they get this information don't know where to go and verify it. So many people just begin to believe it. And when you have an election process like the one that we have in India, which is on such a large, huge scale, the issue of fake news is a huge one. It's not something that's just specific to these elections. We've seen deaths in India over the past 18 months because of fake reports being spread about people turning up in different areas to kidnap children. So it's a huge, huge problem in the world's largest democracy.
Talk about that example that you just mentioned. How could the spread of fake news, or how is it resulting, as you said, in even the loss of life in India?
If we go to one of the most high-profile cases that happened in the state not very far from where I'm speaking to you from, in Jharkhand, where we had a man who basically in May 2017 turned up in a particular village in Jharkhand, and this was a case where we'd had these rumors being perpetuated by social media that people were coming into areas to kidnap children. He was then accused of doing that, and before any sort of justice process could take place, he was lynched. So there's a very specific case of WhatsApp, and that's not an isolated incident, Lisa. We have seen other cases like that in this country.
And what have you seen that has a bearing on the election itself? Give us an example of what different parties are perpetrating misinformation, how they're doing that online.
You see, the difficulty is you don't know if it's coming from the parties themselves because it's not on their official sites. I mean, if I look at my phone now, every day there's WhatsApp messages that come to me about politics. I'm not quite sure where they're coming from. They will say specific things about another party, another candidate, being weak on a particular issue, etc., or maybe favoring a particular community here in India.
There is, of course, in the United States, great concern about the influence of Russia in the last election here. Is there any indication that there is outside of India, outside influences, trying to have a bearing on the election right now in India?
It's very difficult to say, but we know that just before the election process began, that Facebook took down a whole number of pages from its site. Some of those were linked to political parties in this country. Some were linked to the neighboring country of Pakistan, whether that was an attempt to influence the elections or not. I think we're far too early in that process to see. So there may well be at some point a wider discussion about international implications. But at this moment in time, the debate that we're talking about, Lisa, is really to do with how politicians and political parties and people around them are behaving in India.
This is a huge election, I mean, in every way, with a number of people voting, and there's a lot at stake here, obviously, especially for the Prime Minister Modi, who's looking for a second term in office. Is the problem of false information being spread on social media enough to sway this election? I mean, what is at stake here?
I think if you look at how Mr. Modi won the last election, social media was a key factor in it. And social media will be a key factor in whether he is re-elected again or not. In what was perceived to have been a tight election, maybe up to 6 or 7 weeks ago before the problems with Pakistan took place, which seemed to have given the Prime Minister a huge boost, when jobs was the focus, when the economy was the focus, I think there was a feeling that misinformation could help sway the election. But I think at this particular point in time, with the Prime Minister so far ahead in the opinion polls, whether you want to trust them or not is another factor. Whilst there is huge concern about fake news, there are other issues that are way, way above this particular one when it comes to the debate and the discussion that is taking place around the elections here in India.
The BBC's Rahul Tandon speaking with us from Kolkata, India, on this day one of the election for India. Thank you so much, Rahul.
Thanks very much, Lisa.
This week, President Trump threw a tough pitch at Major League Baseball, a brushback, his administration declaring that the deal the league reached last December with the Cuban Baseball Federation was illegal. That deal would have allowed Cuban baseball players to play ball in the U.S. without having to defect. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, we spoke in December. Remind us why this was such a big deal.
Well, the Major League Baseball has long had Cuban players in its ranks. But ever since Castro took over as dictator and prevented people from freely emigrating from that island, baseball players have had to get here by the same means that other Cubans have had to get here, which is to say they've often used human traffickers and the families of stars who we know have sometimes been left behind. And guys who've been on all-star teams and might even be in the Hall of Fame have had to go through these harrowing experiences to pay the traffickers. And so finally, Major League Baseball stepped in and tried to do something to remedy this. But there were complications because, and we could get into this, Cuba's not like South Korea, not like Japan, and the same deals you strike with the Cuban Baseball Federation is not going to be like the deals you strike with a Nippon professional baseball team.
And the Cuban Federation was going to get a fee from Major League Baseball, and that's what you're speaking of. They have agreements with, you know, Japan, for instance.
Yeah.
But it was seen, you know, as a win-win for both sides. The players wouldn't have to risk their lives, give up their citizenship. The Cuban Federation would get a little something, so they would allow them to come. And baseball here in the U.S. would obviously get something. So why does the Trump administration say this is illegal? And how much does this have to do with the politics of people, many in the U.S., who don't want to have what are becoming increasingly better relations with Cuba?
It has a lot to do with those politics, and it might not even be it might not even be the kind of action that the Trump administration took that is an outlier among the Republican Party or people who are against the Castro regime. Let's put it this way. As so often happens during a discussion of baseball, I will quote from the Yale Journal of International Law.
Yes, often this happens. Go
yes,
ahead.
Yes, yes. This and they say that they say that it is unlikely that this Trump administration's ruling will be overturned. And the reason for that is that the president's constitutional and statutory authority includes the power to impose virtually any type of economic sanction. So the Trump administration says giving money to the Cuban Baseball Federation is essentially giving money to Cuba. that is an economic sanction. We want to continue on this economic sanction. It also has the benefit, in the eyes of the Trump administration, to undo an Obama-era policy, which is something that they always want to do. And it's being applauded by a lot of South Florida legislators and a lot of people who love baseball and love the Cubans playing baseball, but don't want to give a dollar to the Cuban government.
Look, the timing is interesting. Of course, the season just started, and according to the Washington Post, the Cuban Baseball Federation, as if to underscore what people thought was going to happen, just released a list of more than 30 players who are eligible to play in the U.S. I'm not sure what kind of signal they're trying to send. But, I mean, does this mean we're going to start seeing people taking those risks again? I mean, if you knew you were this close to a deal, you know, with yeah. Major League Baseball, and you're living in, you know, probably not very good economic means in Cuba, what are you going to do? Are we going to see players defecting again?
I would think so, because the deals that you could get in Major League Baseball are so far beyond the wildest imagination of the average American, to say nothing of the average Cuban. And let's also say that Cuba is far from an innocent in this. When we talked about Japan or South Korea, you know, you're allowed to leave those countries if you want to leave, right? So Cuba could let its players leave without taking a cut of the money. The fact that the government has, look, I mean, it's a communist system, so the government's going to have major controls over lots of businesses there, but the fact that the government has a hand in making money on the back of their athletes and is preventing them from leaving, that's as big a problem as the Trump administration stepping in and saying, no, this cannot be allowed to happen. It's actually not that surprising. It fits in with a lot of Trump administration policies. The only chance I thought that it might have a passing is that Trump and his administration sometimes has a soft spot for sports, and he gives, you know, posthumous pardons to boxers and so forth, and he claims to be a big fan of sports. I know he loves golf. So you thought that, and the celebrity aspect, you thought maybe that alone would sort of allow the Trump administration to contradict a lot of its other policy in terms of Cuba, in terms of things that Barack Obama and his administration did, and in terms of immigration. But no, they're being consistent with the Cuban baseball policy as they have with all the other policies.
And just briefly, does this affect at all the players from Cuba who are already in Major League Baseball?
No, it doesn't. They've all made a break from Cuba, but I think most of them were applauding this policy so that their countrymen and perhaps future teammates and future professional players wouldn't have to go through the absolute hardships that they had to go through, the horrors in some cases.
Yeah. Mike Pesca here now is a sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.